whenever I report on the potential for life on Mars, experiments to search for life on Mars, human beings attempting to live on Mars, people will post in the comments, what about the perchlorates? These are, of course, these chlorine molecules that are mixed in the upper levels of the regolith on Mars, and they are toxic. And the quantities are millions of times more than what is permissible, you know, in your water supply. And so you need to get these perchlorates out. Now, the easy solution, and the one that I casually, flippantly say, is, well, you just wash your dirt. And yes, that works. You can wash the perchlorates out and you'll have nice, clean regolith, but it uses a lot of water, and water on Mars is very precious. So what if we could just let life fix this problem for us? Well, my guests today have just won a NASA NIAC grant for this very question. Their grant is called Detoxifying Mars, the biocatalytic elimination of omnipresent perchlorates. And the gist is that they have found an organism that they think can strip away oxygen molecules from the perchlorate so that you've got breathable atmosphere and you're left with chlorine. You can do things with it. You can mix it into water and you can sterilize things, or you can use it as an energy source. There's all kinds of things you can do with it once you've gotten it out of the regolith, out of the water, in a form that you can handle. So today I'm talking to Dr. Lynn Rothschild, who I talked to last year about building a pharmacy in space, and again, using life forms to be able to create your various drugs and chemicals. She's a senior research scientist at NASA Ames. And I'm also joined by Dr. Garrett Roberts-Kingman, who is a NASA postdoctoral program fellow in astrobiology at NASA Ames. And they are working on this Detoxifying Mars proposal. Fascinating stuff. We spend the first half of the interview just like talking about that. And then we spend the second half just talking about the search for life on Mars in general, what perchlorates tell us about life on Mars, what new technologies are coming out to adapt organisms for really extreme environments, places we should be looking for extreme life forms. It's a really interesting conversation about sort of like the cutting edge of astrobiology and bioengineering and space exploration. So I think you're really going to enjoy it. All right, enjoy this interview with Lynn and Garrett. Lynn, Garrett, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
Great to be here.
And Lynn, it's like been like a year. I think we talked about the 2023 NIAC Awards, and now you're back with a different one.
Oh, gosh, yes. I mean, I never let a good NIAC opportunity pass by. I have a former student who called us the Idea Lab, and I'm sticking with that. I love that.
Yeah.
That sort of has become our role in life, is to find where the gaps are and do our best to fill them. And, you know, we don't know everything about everything, but we certainly can get things started and hope that other people get excited and carry them through.
Well, and if you check your email box, the 2025 solicitation just came in. So, you know, if you got another idea, that would be the time.
Very excited about that.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, so today we're going to talk about perchlorates and how to deal with them. And this is funny, because every time I'll do a video about Mars and like the ideas about some kind of long-term habitability of Mars and so on, people will just go in the comments all about perchlorates. So Garrett, what are the perchlorates and how do we learn about them on Mars?
Great question. So perchlorates are a kind of salt present in the dirt on Mars, or as we call it, regolith. It's one chlorine atom with four oxygen atoms attached to it. It's a very high energy molecule that is a very powerful oxidizer, which means that it oxidizes many things it comes in contact to, including biologicals such as humans, if humans eventually go there. We only learned about humans relatively recently. It was with the Phoenix lander that landed on Mars in 2007, I believe it was. That was when we first discovered it. So our knowledge of perchlorates on Mars is actually shockingly recent. And we've known since discovering them, and they are present at a fairly high concentration, that they're a problem that we're going to need to address one way or another when humans go to Mars.
So give me a sense, Lynn, if I like took a scoop of Mars, like a sample, and brought it into the lab and just started from the very surface and started to measure down into the regolith, when would the perchlorate stop and when would they end, and sort of what levels of concentration would we find?
You want to take that, Garrett?
Yeah. So perchlorates are present at about 0.5% by mass, 0.5% to 1% by mass, depending a little bit on which measurement and which part of the planet. One of the really interesting things is we don't actually know how far down into the regolith they go, because we have yet to drill deeply on Mars. And that's one of the things the future robotic missions will be able to answer for us. It is likely that they are more concentrated in the upper layers, as they're thought to be caused by high energy cosmic and solar rays hitting chlorine atoms in the regolith and then causing an energetic chemical reaction. And that is, of course, happening more at the surface where these particles are strongest. But we really don't know how deep they go. But we do know they are uniformly present across the planet. And again, at fairly high concentrations of 0.5% to 1% by mass.
But it is surprising to me that there's that much chlorine present on Mars. When you think about it, you think about the iron and the oxide. Where's all this chlorine coming from? Lynn?
I was just going to say that actually I became more aware of it. You know, we hear these results from different missions and, you know, perchlorates and there's this and there's that. And, you know, that's nice. And we go on with our daily business. You almost become numb to some of this. And then, oh, I guess it was probably about 8 or 10 years ago, I was in my office and I got a phone call from the center director's office, which I did with some amount of regularity in those days, but it's still very unusual for the center director's office to call. And basically the message was, get your tail into Pete's office immediately. He's concerned about perchlorates on Mars. And there were about six of us who were called in, and he just looked at us and said, what are we going to do about it? It's like, I don't know. And so that's sort of when it became, you know, really fixed on my radar screen that we needed to do something about it.
And what's the health hazard of the perchlorates? Why is this such a big problem? Why they called you into the office? Why is this so serious?
It's serious because, as you say, there are serious health hazards. In fact, the state of California has a limit of perchlorates that is in the sort of range of 6 parts per billion, but you're talking on surface of Mars is something like 50 million parts per billion. I mean, this is orders and orders of magnitude more than what the state of California would consider toxic. And so as an oxidizer, it creates havoc with all sorts of biomolecules. I mean, you know, forget the fact that it also caused problems with various organs, but I mean, it's just ripping through your body, causing havoc. And so it's not something you would drink, and certainly not in the levels that you're talking about on Mars. People don't think of us as watery creatures, but we are. Humans are about 60% water. In preparation for this interview, I looked it up, and actually men are slightly more watery than women, it turns out, because they have a higher muscle mass, and women tend to have a higher fat mass, and muscles have more water than fat. So men are a little more watery than women, but as a whole, we're a very watery group of organisms. And so we need to have the water. We need to drink it. And if we're killing ourselves with toxins at the same time, that's obviously a no-go. Something's got to give, and we've got to get rid of these perchlorates.
And so, Gary, what was the kind of the traditional idea about getting rid of these perchlorates? I mean, the answer that I always give people is to wash your regolith.
Yeah, so it depends in part on what you're trying to purify. You can wash the regolith, and then you'll have pretty clean regolith. That mm-hmm. will absolutely work. But an increasingly important idea as we slowly move forward and closer to going to Mars is the idea that water itself is a very precious resource, and perchlorate in the water is actually a problem that needs solving too. In particular, if you think about large-scale ice mining that could be used to make propellant for return trips to Earth, or if you want to grow food on Mars, or you want to turn the water into oxygen, all of these things require water, and perchlorate in the water will be quite a problem that needs dealing with.
Well, even worse. I mean, I always figure there are other forms of propellant. You can you can do other sorts of things, but we have an absolute requirement for water. Any living organism we have there, and Garrett mentioned the crops, but the astronauts themselves have got to have clean, potable water. And so one of the ways that people might get rid of perchlorates on the Earth or even on in space would be distillation. But now you're talking a lot of energy to boil the water and then have it reform. So you're wasting energy, huge amounts there. You can do desalination, which some people do in coastal areas to get rid of the perchlorates. And again, this is very energy intensive. It's a difficult thing. But it turns out there are a couple of organisms, there are a couple of microbes that can actually do this for us. So as Garrett mentioned, perchlorate is four oxygen atoms tied onto a chlorine. And there's one enzyme that will pull off the first two oxygen atoms and so give you molecular oxygen, oxygen that we breathe. And the second one will pull off the other two, and then you're left with two molecules of oxygen, which is perfectly good for breathing or propellant or whatever. And then you have the chlorine, which could be used to disinfect water in a controlled way or you know, whatever other use you might want to have for it.
So let's talk about your actual NIAC proposal. So what are you proposing?
So we have these organisms that we know can detoxify perchlorate. And there have been various means I've gone to over the last 15 years where microbiologists who are specialists in these organisms said, oh, this would be great. We could detoxify Mars as this. The problem is the organisms that have these particular enzymes are not particularly easy to grow. They're not ones that I would want to count on off planet. But we do have an organism that we've used for quite a few years in my lab that we can count on. And that's a microbe called Bacillus subtilis. So this is a very common soil bacterium. In fact, because it lives in the soil and has to withstand heat and rain and drying and all sorts of things, they form spores. And that allows them to withstand bad conditions and go from place to place. Now, it turns out one of the really bad conditions that the spores can withstand is space itself. In fact, these spores have been flowing outside of a satellite, the Long Duration Exposure Facility, for nearly 6 years, and many of them survived. And so this is why when I had a payload on a German satellite a few years ago, we flew Bacillus subtilis. As I always tell people, it's not that I have an emotional attachment to Bacillus subtilis, but it lets me sleep at night. We can count on it. So Garrett's idea was really to take these enzymes from organisms that can do this for us, can detoxify the perchlorate and pull out the oxygen in a form that we could then breathe, and put that ability into the Bacillus subtilis, which is so space hardy.
And just to expand upon that, mm-hmm. Another limitation of these organisms that natively reduce perchlorate is that they're is not much perchlorate anywhere on Earth. And so they're not used to finding a lot of perchlorate. And it's basically their emergency backup food source when all else is lacking. In particular, they will not express these genes that detoxify perchlorate when there's any oxygen whatsoever around. If there's oxygen, they would rather use that than perchlorate. But of course, when we're talking about humans going to Mars, the astronauts are going to want to be in their own little habitat with lots of oxygen. So in that case, if you were to use these native organisms, even if you could transport there and they would culture fine, they would not actually make these enzymes, these little biocatalytical machines that would do the task that we want. And then a final challenge that we're solving is that even when they are in the perfect conditions and they are making these perchlorate reduction enzymes, they actually only make them in a very small amount because there's low perchlorate levels that they're used to. And so they don't need a lot of these proteins around. But there's a lot of perchlorate on Mars, and our goal is to get rid of as much of it from the water supply or the regolith we're trying to grow crops in as possible, as quickly as possible. And so we really want to express these genes at a very high level. And so we can solve both of those secondary problems while we're moving it to Bacillus subtilis by putting the genes that tell the cell how to make these enzymes under the control of what's called a strong promoter that basically says, make a lot of these all the time, whether there's oxygen or whether there's not a lot of oxygen, just make a lot of them.
So give me a sense, like practically, like the astronauts have landed on Mars, they've brought the box with them that contains the bacteria. How would they actually go about the process of cleaning the regolith in their water?
Well, this is what I think is kind of clever about it, is that I don't know if you realize this, but both Garrett and I in our other lives are astrobiologists. So we're very interested in the question of whether there might be life on Mars. And so what we envision is the first step is that you would filter the water. You would get some of the, you know, big things out that you don't want, maybe little fragments of regolith or who knows what. But if you do that preliminary filter, there's always a possibility that there's something on that other side of the filter that's interesting to an astrobiologist. So you almost have a built-in astrobiology experiment. But for the human part, back to our human hats, we have this water that's now been filtered. And what Garrett's been doing is making Bacillus subtilis that can then make these enzymes, either take them and make them internally. And so the idea would be the Bacillus subtilis would pick up some of the perchlorates and detoxify it. But I think even cleverer is the idea of making these enzymes and then secreting them. So the Bacillus makes them and then sort of spits them out into the water so that it can clean it up. So now you don't need to worry about the Bacillus either, because it's just spitting out these enzymes to clean up the perchlorate. And then presumably you could capture the oxygen and then the rest of the water would be, you know, good to go to drink.
But what would be the throughput?
That's one of the questions we're hoping to answer here. We don't have an answer yet. It entirely depends on the performance of these enzymes, which is... one of the goals of the study is to characterize how much of these enzymes we can make and what their catalytic turnover rate is once produced.
So this is probably a good time to mention that we're 50% of the team. We do have Stephen Hoffman from as a contractor at the Johnson Space Center, and he's been very involved in mission designs, including digging for water on the surface of Mars. Carol Stoker, who's a colleague of mine at Ames, has also been very involved in drilling apparatuses for Mars. And so they're looking a little bit more at the mechanics and how we would put this whole system together. But the way the NIAC program goes is that the phase one proposals are nominally 9 months to see if there's a there. So we don't get a huge amount of money, but we have enough to start to explore this idea and see if it's worth pursuing. And that's what we're doing at this point. If we find that this is really successful, we will go on to a phase two, hopefully convince the program that we're ready for a phase two. And then that becomes a two-year study where you start to nail down some of these issues that you quite rightly bring up. And then if we're fortunate enough to ultimately go to a phase three, that's when you really start to transition this into a potential customer, whether it's a commercial space or NASA or another government space agency. So that's sort of where we are in the whole grand scheme. We're at the very early stages saying, okay, we're trying to do something about the perchlorates. Is our approach a valid one? Does it make sense? Is it worth pursuing? And most NIAC projects that are funded are not. They assume that many of them are so far out that there's nothing there, or once they start investigating it, they had missed some critical part, or you know, maybe there's a better way to do it. That's perfectly fine. They're assuming that. And so that's the whole purpose of going in on the NIACs, these high-risk proposals, to see if there's a there. And that's what sort of the stage we are at right now.
Right. And obviously, there's going to be some kind of waste product, right? You've got this chlorine, and you got to figure out what to do with it. Do you have an idea of what you might do with it, Garrett?
Yeah, so the chlorine, it will become chloride, which is, we encounter it frequently as one half of a common salt, sodium chloride. You know, so depends in part on what the water, its water is the application we're mostly thinking of here. What is going to be used for next? If you're going to use it for growing crops, a lot of crops will grow just fine in slightly salty water. So that won't be a problem. You can kind of leave it in exactly as is. Whereas if you grow them in perchlorate water, then the crops will have perchlorate in them, and that would be very bad for astronaut health. So for some applications, you could leave it exactly as is. For some other applications, even the residual chloride could be a problem and could require further filtering through some distillation or desalination process. But one of the big advantages of this pre-processing with biology is that all of the potential engineering approaches you could add on for further purification are made immensely easier by reducing the amount of perchlorate available for two reasons. One is that the perchlorate is not only bad for humans, it can interact with a lot of the machinery and equipment itself. If you're trying to desalinate water through a reverse osmosis membrane, for example, the perchlorate as a potent oxidizer will dramatically increase the wear rate of those membranes, meaning you need to bring a lot more of these supplies to Mars, which supplies and mass to Mars is going to be very much a limiting factor. So that's one big improvement. The other big improvement is that a lot of processes may be able to tolerate some salts, but the amount of salt will depend on what salt it is. So Lynn mentioned earlier that we need to reduce perchlorate by about 100,000 to 1,000,000-fold to be at safe levels for human consumption in the water. But if you can convert all of that to chloride, then you don't need to reduce it 1,000,000-fold to have safe levels of chloride. A 10-fold reduction could make it quite safe to drink and quite operational or quite satisfactory for propellant production, for example.
Right. And I mean, most of us are familiar with a little bit of chlorine in our water for safety.
I took the liberty of doing a little Googling last night for uses of chlorine on Mars. And that's, of course, the first thing that comes up is purification of the water. So we may not want to drink it at that concentration, but we may be able to then have a side benefit that we can use a little bit of it as a water purification method.
So bringing novel bacteria, in some cases, stuff that's designed to work in these kinds of conditions, or stuff that's actually been engineered to do a fantastic job in these kinds of conditions, what do you think are the implications for planetary protection about, you know, the actual environment of Mars?
Well, I mean, that's obviously an issue. And again, both of us are very concerned about looking for life on Mars. And, you know, put it right out there, I don't think there would be a greater tragedy than if there was a living organism on Mars, an indigenous life form, and we destroyed the ability to find it from our carelessness. That being said, by the time we have humans there, human life is going to take priority in that particular region. No one is going to suggest, well, you can't, you know, walk outside, you can't vent because we might hurt a Martian when an astronaut's life's in danger. And so we're going to have to figure these things out before we have human missions. That being said, something like Bacillus subtilis is considered safe for humans. In fact, I discovered recently that Bacillus subtilis is used as a probiotic in some foods. So that can be safe. We could also do something else kind of clever since we're engineering them anyway, and that is put a watermark. Give a sequence in the DNA that says, basically, this was made in Lynn and Garrett's lab. And so if anyone ever finds it again, they know, oh yeah, that's the one that came from NASA Ames. That's not an indigenous life form, so we don't need to worry about it. But again, it's going to be an overall problem for a human mission, and our particular Bacillus subtilis is not going to be the issue. It's going to be an entire microbial ecosystem that comes with humans.
And I'll just expand on that and say that we envision using this in the context of a human mission to Mars. And you cannot have a human mission to Mars without bacteria going to Mars. There are more bacterial cells in a human being than there are human cells in a human being.
Speak for yourself.
And we also, from that sense, we don't anticipate that using microbial biotechnology inside the human habitat that will be deployed, that humans will be living and breathing and being kind of slightly messy germ bags inside of, will increase the challenges of planetary protection. And there will be challenges of planetary protection, but we don't think that this project will move the needle on that front.
Yeah, I guess there's, you know, only so many times you can put a human being into an autoclave and try to clean off the bacteria and still have viable human beings. I don't know if I worry about it, but I do think about that idea that you go to Mars and every rock you turn over just has more cyanobacteria, and like, that's weird. Like, where'd this stuff come from? Well, we brought it because
Yeah, though I think that's very unlikely to happen on most of Mars because the atmospheric pressure is such that you don't have liquid water on the surface. Now, I think the question of potentially a fluid inclusion in the ice in the South Pole region is possible. I've asked plenty of planetary scientists. I said, I'm a microbiologist. I don't need a global ocean. I said, if you're a microbe, 50 microliters of liquid water is a global ocean. Could you find me 50 microliters? And they said, oh, of course we can find you 50 microliters. So they're, you know, they're little places, but for the most part, you're not going to see something living on the surface or under a rock because you don't get the liquid water. And every life form we know about needs liquid water as a solvent. It's an absolute requirement.
And this species, Bacillus subtilis, it works, it's extreme tolerant in its inert spore form, but it cannot grow in even slightly extreme conditions. Mm-hmm. And talked about it surviving on the outside of the space station, which it can when it's in a spore form, but it's not growing. It's not doing any metabolism there. If we were to take one of these cultures and just put it in our refrigerator for a week, they're all dead. So this species is not, if I were to try and design a species that could live in Martian conditions, it would not be this one.
But that being said, people in the synthetic biology community have talked for the last dozen years or so about the potential of engineering a kill switch in. So, for example, you engineer your Bacillus subtilis so that they get a certain dose of radiation, which they would in, you know, you could pick your level, say, in an hour on the surface of Mars, it automatically kills the cell. It releases a series of biochemical reactions that would basically have the cell commit suicide. So we could actually put kill switches in if this becomes a problem, if it becomes an issue. And again, we have talked over the years to the Planetary Protection Officer at NASA headquarters, and this whole question of what you do for planetary protection with a human mission has not been well thought out. And so we can't really respond to something at this point that is not well thought out. But clearly, once it is, there has to be back and forth. And clearly, we would have to follow any sort of protocols that were promulgated.
What does like this concentration of perchlorate on Mars, when you do put that astrobiologist hat on as opposed to the trying to clean it up, does it give you any perspective on the habitability of Mars? I mean, that stuff seems pretty tough to survive in, and yet we're searching for life on Mars in meters potentially of poison.
That's absolutely true. And because it's not something that just affects, you know, maybe DNA or maybe a particular biomolecule, but that it can oxidize basically every biomolecule, it is a problem unless we had a radically different life form or they had evolved in a lower perchlorate environment and it evolved a way to keep the perchlorate out and somehow have this detoxification mechanism on the cell surface. And so it does suggest between the perchlorate and the UV flux that those areas at the surface would likely be sterile today with any life form. And we can discuss this now or some other time, but I happen to believe, and it's not due to lack of imagination, that if you're going to have life in our solar system and potentially anywhere, that there's a very good chance that it would be based on organic carbon chemistry, which is what life is based on here. And I'm not talking about, you know, the organic section of your grocery store. I'm talking about anything that's any organisms built with carbon chemistry. So basically any carbon molecule except CO2 and carbon monoxide or a diamond. But if you have a carbon molecule, you're then going to be susceptible to radiation damage and the perchlorate damage. And so that would prohibit, as you say, every life form that on Earth, and certainly the ones that I could conceive of that we have in the solar system. And the reason I'm so sure about it is not just the fact that that our chemistry is built on this, and not just the fact that carbon chemistry is much more versatile than anything else, much more versatile even than silicon chemistry, but our colleagues who are interstellar chemists take telescopes and they look out in the interstellar medium, or our colleagues down the hall who study meteorites or comets, all see the same kind of carbon chemistry that our bodies are made out of. And so at some point you have to open your ears and say, the solar system, the universe is telling us something, that this language that we are built on is actually the language of life. And if that's true, that means any organism there would be susceptible to this damage from both the radiation and the perchlorate.
And perchlorate is a challenge for life, but it's not necessarily an insurmountable challenge for life. There are a few organisms that are known here on Earth and shown in the laboratory to grow quite happily in the presence of even 10 times more perchlorate than we see on the right. surface of Mars. And one of the interesting things about them is they are not organisms that are anywhere near any perchlorate whatsoever on Earth. They're general halophiles. They're exposed to different kinds of salts. And it turns out that a lot of those mechanisms that help them adapt to other kinds of salts help them to deal with perchlorates as well.
But how do you get started? You know, if you have the primitive soup sort of thing of biomolecules, of proteins or, you know, other sorts of polymers that are susceptible, then you've got a problem. So you might need to at least find a place to have life start that doesn't
right.
have concentration.
I mean, it sounds like the same sort of idea of like the transition from oceans to land. Like you start out in the ocean and it's safe, and then you find tidal zones and I guess places where perchlorates and not perchlorates are mixing, and you get accustomed to it and eventually make your way farther and farther through it. But you know, you mentioned some of these kinds of life forms on Earth that do have certain sorts of behaviors. And now that we think about the Viking experiment, right? There was take a bunch of dirt, feed it a bunch of food, measure the gases, argue for 30 years. That's the experiment, right? But now we know what the upper layer of Mars is probably more likely. That could indicate certain kinds of life forms that are working with the perchlorates as part of their system. Does that give you ideas, or does that give you suggestions on what we could be looking for a next generation experiments to search for life on Mars?
I mean, it also may be suggesting that the life is in an area where there are not high levels of perchlorate or deep down, or, you know, and just to be clear, I happen to think the Viking missions were brilliant. I know it's very popular to say, oh, well, you know, what did they know? But these were experiments designed by actually a whole, I don't know what the word is for a group of Nobel Prize winners. I don't think it's a gaggle, but, you know, it's the group of Nobel Prize winners, literally, who thought about this, what would be an agnostic sign of life? And as I mentioned before, if all life is based on organic carbon, then various changes in different states of the organic carbon or different inputs and outputs would be an agnostic way to measure whether there's life. And that's basically what the Viking did. What if you put in carbon dioxide that was labeled with radioactivity so you can follow it? Does any of it get incorporated into cells just like it would be in a photosynthetic organism on the Earth? What if you give it basically labeled food, other proteins or amino acids, would it take those in and produce something else? That's what Viking, for the most part, was looking for with these transformations. And so I do actually think it was very clever. They didn't know about the perchlorates. There were a lot of things they didn't know about. And yes, the sensitivity wasn't the same as the instruments are today. But I think the strategy was actually very clever. And I've certainly don't fault them. I think that it was rather brilliant. And by the way, a lot of people don't realize there was also a camera just in case some Martian walked by and it's like, ha ha, what are you doing with the test tubes? Here I am. So, I mean, they really did have their bases covered.
Perchlorates could be very useful for Martian life, if there is any, in two different ways. One is that, like we discussed earlier, they are a energy-rich molecule, so they could absolutely play a key role in the metabolism of any Martian microbes that could exist. The other way that they could be very actually beneficial for any life on Mars is that they are known to form these, or at least suspected to form these very concentrated brines underground, very salty water with lots of perchlorates that's actually liquid. At the very low temperatures of Mars. So if you ask me to pick a single place on Mars where I thought we might have the best chance of discovering life on Mars alive today, it would be these underground perchlorate brines that were discovered near the South Pole.
Like this will lower the freezing temperature of the water so that you can have liquid water in places and times when it should just be frozen solid.
Exactly. And we're talking about minus 50 degrees or so.
It's the same idea as putting salt on the roads in the winter, you know, in spades.
Yeah, that's interesting. And so what could be toxic to us could actually be keeping the planet alive.
Yes. By preserving a liquid water medium for certain microbes to potentially grow within.
So what is the plan now? What are you expected to deliver as part of this report?
Well, we have the geologists, as I mentioned, Carol Stoker and Stephen Hoffman, who are working on sort of a mission concept. You know, you would have the rover and you had the deep drilling and you would be bringing up water that would then go through some kind of system and so on. And what my lab is focusing on, primarily Garrett, is the bioengineering of these organisms. Can you actually make a Bacillus subtilis that will then produce the enzymes that are needed to detoxify the perchlorate? So the way I like to describe it with synthetic biology is we're raiding nature's genetic hardware store. So here's this capability. It's like you go in the hardware store and you see a hammer and you see a screwdriver and a saw. But, you know, you want them in a different kind of conformation, or you might want them in a different color, or whatever. So you take them and you take them out of one organism and you put them into an organism that you want to express them in. So you just swap them around. You take advantage of these genetic capabilities and put it in the tractable organism. And there is no reason this shouldn't work. I have great faith in Garrett, but you know, there are a lot of things that should work that don't always work in the lab. In fact, one of my favorite New Yorker cartoons, although I can't find it, now I got to go find it, is basically two scientists saying, how do you spell Eureka backwards? I mean, that's the life of a scientist many days is trying to spell Eureka backwards. But I have great faith that by the end of the year, Garrett's going to figure this out. And if he doesn't, that may say something as well, not just maybe about Garrett, but more likely about how we can approach this problem and that we may have to go to a plan B.
Yeah, and we're fairly confident we can engineer these bacteria to express these genes. The big questions will be, what is the throughput? How much perchlorate can we reduce? How quickly with how much culture? That's one of the big questions we're looking to answer. And it may be that number is satisfactory, and then we can kind of declare victory and move on to figuring out how to best operationalize the system for a human mission. It could be that the turnover rate, the rate of perchlorate reduction, is lower than we're looking for. And then we could try and engineer the proteins themselves. And this, you know, there are a couple of reasons why we may be able to change the proteins, so kind of modify the hammer, to extend Lynn's analogy, to work better for the specific purposes that we want to use the hammer for. We don't think we're going to make a better hammer than evolution made, but evolution made a hammer to hammer a very specific kind of nail. We want to hammer these perchlorates in a different environment than it was hammering away before in. And this hammer was also optimized by evolution to try and extract the maximum metabolic energy out of each molecule of perchlorate, because these microbes that we're taking these tools from use it as food. We don't necessarily care about getting the most energy per molecule of perchlorate. We care much more about speed of perchlorate reduction. So if the turnover rate for the product that we create this first time around is lower, we do think there are those two reasons that we can optimize it to better suit our purposes and hopefully get the perchlorate reduction rate fast enough to be much more useful.
Have the tools for doing this kind of work changed dramatically in the last couple of years? I mean, we on the outside of this hear about CRISPR and other techniques for being able to modify organisms or being able to modify DNA, things like that. Are there sort of like new technologies that have come out recently that have made these kinds of projects a lot more feasible?
Well, it's not, it's the new technologies and the fact that it's now become very popular and there's the competition. And so the cost of all these things has come way down. So I ran an undergraduate competitive synthetic biology team for 10 years from 2011 to 2019 through the auspices of a competition called iGEM, the International Genetically Engineered Machine Competition. And for most of the time, most of the first 7 or 8 years, it was a lot of genetic engineering. You had a plasmid, you cut it open, you cut another piece of DNA open, and you linked it together and so on. There's a lot of that. And, you know, you wouldn't dream of synthesizing a segment just de novo because it would be ridiculously expensive. It might be $2,000 to $5,000. That's a lot of your budget for the entire summer. And now the same sort of synthesis costs have come way down. And so if Garrett wants something synthesized, he doesn't even ask me these days. It's just become much more feasible because it's so inexpensive to go to a company and get a lot of these pieces made. You're quite right. The tools are better. CRISPR is certainly one of them, but another one that we're using for both, I assume what Garrett's doing, but then this other project that we have going that we've discussed before, the astropharmacy, where we're secreting drugs from Bacillus subtilis. Now, organisms have various tags on their proteins that indicate that the protein should be secreted. So it's sort of like sticking a letter in a mailbox and you've got the zip code on it. And so the mail knows where to deliver it. This is sort of like attaching a zip code to a protein. But it turns out that even one cell has multiple zip codes that it can use to get a protein out, and some work better with some proteins than others. So this is the sort of thing that in the past we would manually have to go through, and maybe you'd test 3 or 4 or 5, and at that point it's like, all right, we'll just pick the best one. Well, at this point, we buy a kit from a company that just allows us to test, I don't know, 100, 200 different ones of these like little genetic zip codes at one time. And so we can say, okay, out of this 192 or 200 of them, these 5 work the best, and it's done. So it's that kind of thing that has just made all this so much quicker. We've also miniaturized this. When I was a grad student a gazillion years ago, we used a lot of 50 mil tubes and bigger, and you know, you do single sets of samples, and it was a big deal. And then we started using smaller tubes, but it still was a big deal to do 20 or 30 samples. And now these sorts of things, you know, we have plate readers that will measure 384 samples at once, or 1082. I mean, it's ridiculous, the ability of this high throughput lab techniques. And that's something that really has been a huge boon to not just basic researchers like us, but industry has driven that, including the medical industry, but all industries, even companies that, for example, make the detergent for your laundry. These enzymes are not picked one at a time now. They're picked through high throughput methods like this, where they can screen 1,000 at one time. So all these technologies, not just CRISPR, but a whole series of technologies do allow us to move much faster than we used to. But don't tell the NIAC program. They don't know that.
And there are huge
advances. They don't watch these anyway. Yeah.
Nah. Nah.
There are huge advances, not just in the laboratory, but also computationally, in particular with AlphaFold, allowing to solve and to visualize 3D protein structures. So much of how enzymes work is due to their literal geometry, what kind of charge molecule or charge atoms are here or there with relationship to each other. And up until very recently, if you wanted to understand how a protein functioned, you had to go through an honestly very arduous process to crystallize it and do X-ray crystallography or something similar to determine its structure. And now there are some tools that you can use, and you can just put in the primary amino acid sequence of a protein, and it will show you with a prediction with very high confidence of what this actually looks like. Lets you be able to look at obscure enzymes that people haven't done, haven't created structures for. Or if you're interested in, well, if I were to change this amino acid right here, mm-hmm. what impact would it have on the structure? And you know, we can address these much, much more easily and with higher confidence now that these deep learning models are so powerful.
Yeah, and you, I mean, you mentioned AlphaFold, which I did want to bring up. But even I know that people are like with large language models with transformers, they are, you know, everyone's familiar with chatbots and drawing pictures, but they're just hungry for data. And so if I know that there's a lot of really interesting work that's being done where you feed them material capabilities, or you feed them genetic information, or you feed them and they start to make predictions, and that there have been novel antibiotics that have been developed or at least theorized or proven in the last couple of years, purely theoretically, like the AI has just said, you'll probably find some compounds that will perform antibiotic functions over in this area of chemistry. Is this starting to accelerate the whole process too? It's almost telling you where to look for your bacteria.
Yes, but that whole field of bioinformatics has been coming at us for a while now. And it's suddenly being called AI. So I finally asked in a meeting a couple of weeks ago, so what is the dividing line between bioinformatics and AI? And they said, new word, same thing. So
let's ask ChatGPT, see what it tells us.
We've been working on, but certainly the algorithms have gotten better and better, no question.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, what do you think is, like, how do you think the next couple of decades are going to play out as people who are in this field at a time when the computation is rising exponentially, when the tools and techniques are getting better and better? What do you sort of foresee?
I foresee that we're going to be using a lot more biology to do tasks traditionally done by non-biological means. A buzzword that was kind of floating around for a while but never quite took off is nanotechnology. Biology is nanotechnology. You cannot possibly get a better system for moving molecules around and making novel connections than enzymes that have been created over a long period of evolution. And so the future I see coming in the next 10, 20 years is we're going to learn how to harness biology to catalyze a lot of very specific chemical reactions and to make very specific molecules that we used to have to make very inefficiently. And we're now going to be able to make them both efficiently and specifically. And that's going to revolutionize a lot of fields as we can use extremely efficient biological solutions to problems that you wouldn't necessarily think of as biological problems.
It's an interesting trope in science fiction where you get this society that is, instead of going down the electrical route, has gone down, or computational route, has gone down the biological route and sort of has the same standard of living. I mean, are we sort of, can you imagine alternative ways that we can accomplish things that we do currently today the hard way, but letting tiny life forms fulfill those?
Oh, gaps. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we've used biological sewage treatment for years. We, you know, all of our food, everything else is biological. And, you know, I couldn't agree more with Garrett, but I have to be fair as an evolutionary biologist. When we've done a comparison, and granted this was about 5 years ago, between peptides, short segments of proteins that could bind metals, we compared some that were naturally evolved to ones that had been designed bioinformatically. The naturally evolved ones were always better. So we're not quite there yet on the AI, and maybe we won't, because evolution goes through twists and turns. It's not necessarily logical. Evolution is all about being better than the other guy. And so you may end up with a solution that would be so counter obvious to AI, but yet is the one that works.
And evolution has its own goals that are not necessarily our goals. Evolution may want to bind metal, but it may want to bind the right amount of metal, whereas we may want to bind as much metal as we possibly can.
Right.
And so
plastic.
Yeah, plastic. Yeah. There have been big advances in plastic digesting enzymes, and I think we'll definitely continue to see more of that in the future as well. Yeah.
I think the bottom line is the last century was the physics century, and there's no question that this is the biology century.
Yeah, I also sort of like think about people who have been growing some flower or plant in their garden for the last 20 years and have been saving the seed every year. And they've just made this organism that is perfectly adapted to their tiny little microclimate. And then they share the seeds with you and it doesn't do that great. You're like, I don't know why it grows so well on my property, you know, and that's just this process of evolution mm-hmm. where you're just driving it forward and getting a really interesting and fascinating result. Lynn, what are you obsessed with right now?
Oh boy. I'm an idea person. I'm obsessed with a thousand different things, but I think some of what Garrett was suggesting on the technology side, I've been obsessed with for a couple of years, this idea of looking at organisms as the ultimate nanotechnology and being able to harvest some of that ability to make nanomaterials without a clean room, to make micromaterials by templating on the surface, by binding metals, by binding silica and graphene and so on. So I'm obsessed with that. And sort of along those lines, I guess I will share it with my closest friends. We are starting to cast our eyes on the field of aeronautics and saying, all right, so we now have this experience with biomaterials. Can we take apart airplanes? Can we make a compostable aircraft? Can we actually make a contribution to green aviation? So my lab meeting yesterday was going to be on something else, and somehow it ended up a whole discussion of, could we actually make an airplane? And so I'm somewhat obsessed with that.
And then a spaceship. When do we get the living spaceship?
Exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, I'm getting obsessed with that, but also we have some projects going on right now that are back to my intellectual roots and the whole reason I got into biology, and that's for evolution of eukaryotes and protists. You know, how do organisms pick up chloroplast to begin with? How do eukaryotes evolve? What are the limits for life on the Earth? We can't really talk about the limits for life in the solar system or the universe until we really have a good idea of what it is on planet Earth. And so I'm sort of at that point in my career that I want the new ideas, but I also want to go revisit some of the older ones that have been put on hold because of, you know, being distracted for various reasons into other cool projects. And so we're doing a lot of really fun, really cool things right now.
And Garrett?
I'm really interested in the potential for life beyond Earth. I think we know not everything, but a reasonable amount about what organisms that we find on Earth are capable of, but they have evolved to deal with the challenges they face. And as diverse as the many, many environments on Earth are, it's an incredibly cushy place compared to all the environments in our solar system and beyond. And so I think we really don't understand the limits of biology, even biology broadly following the same biochemistry as we have here on Earth, because it hasn't been pushed to its limits. And without knowing what its biochemical limits are in terms of being able to withstand various environments, I think we are very likely underestimating the potential for life beyond Earth. So that's what I'm really working on in the rest of
it. I mean, it's tough, right? Because a lot of those places, those extreme places, are really inaccessible too. The bottom of the ice on Europa or Enceladus, or under a layer of hydrocarbons and then ice on Titan. Like, they're not easy to get to, and yet they probably have come up with some really interesting ideas that they'd love to share with us.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're working in the laboratory on trying to push some experimental lab organisms out of their cozy Earth-derived environments into something a little bit more like what you might find at the bottom of the ice shelf of Europa, and kind of as a proof of principle and just as a demonstration that, yeah, maybe we should be thinking more about looking for life in these other places.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Well, Lynn, Garrett, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today. Good luck with your NIAC project. You know, here's hoping you reach phase two.
Thank you so much, Fraser. It's always really fun to talk to you. And, you know, we're incredibly grateful to the NIAC program for everything they've supported in my lab.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure I'll talk to you next year for the other project, for the 2025.
It's possible.
All right. See you guys later.
Thanks so much, Fraser.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Dr. Lynn Rothschild and Dr. Garrett Robert Kingman. Now, I am going to give you my thoughts, but first, I'd like to thank our patrons. Thanks to Abe Kingston, Andrew Gross, David Giltinan, Dennis Alberti, Dustin Cable, Jeremy Madden, Jim Burke, Jordan Young, Josh Schultz, Modso, Paul Rohrbach, Stephen Krasaki, Stephen Fowler Munley, and Vlad Chipolin, who support us at the Master of the Universe level, and all of our supporters on Patreon. I am really fascinated about the potential for us to be able to use biology, life forms, to be able to do some of the heavy lifting of the kind of exploration. And like, I know this is a trope in science fiction that there are certain kinds of extraterrestrials that instead of using technology have evolved life forms to be able to do these same jobs. And they really seem to have their place. And when you think about going to a place like Mars, like the three most important things that you need are energy, energy, and energy, right? And so if we're going to try to do like electrolysis to be able to pull water apart into hydrogen and oxygen, what if we could have some kind of life form that would be able to use sunlight and then be able to do that same chemical process or be able to extract the perchlorates from the regolith without having to necessarily use a lot of other chemicals that are, have to be put into it to simplify the process. So we are just like, we know that life here on Earth has done so much, has gotten into every nook and cranny and has come up with novel ways to accomplish almost every single task that it sets itself up against. There's got to be ways that we can use life and evolution and those capabilities to assist us in the exploration of the solar system. And, you know, like we'll bring them along with us. And so we will explore Mars with our bacteria friends. And I think that's perfectly fine. So I look forward to sort of what this technology leads to in the future. All right, we'll see you next time.